Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
My mother's an architect, yeah. When I was growing up, you know, all the things that we did together were all related. They were all making things and design stuff. She has, you know, she's a really excellent designer, one of the best designers I know. So all of my interests were kind of led to architecture, but she always said, don't be an architect. They don't earn any money. And I think particularly when, you know, when she was younger, she was like, there's no room for women in architecture. It's just rubbish. Just don't even go there. Don't bother. Don't put yourself through that. And she was like, be a research scientist. be a filmmaker. Just don't be an architect.
I'm Tatiana von Preussen. I'm a co-founder and co-director of VPPR Architects, together with Catherine Pease and Jessica Reynolds.
And I'm Owen Wainhouse. On the programme this week is the architect Tatiana von Preussen. Tatiana studied architecture at Cambridge University in the UK. After a year out working for the architecture firm Stanton Williams, she moved to New York to attend Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture to complete her master's. After graduating in 2007, she stayed on in New York, landing a job at James Corner Field Operations, the landscape architecture firm and project lead for the New York High Line, along with the architecture practice Diller, Scofido and Renfro. In 2009, amongst the turmoil of the global financial crisis that was decimating the construction industry in the US, Tatiana returned to London with her friends Catherine Pease and Jessica Reynolds to set up their own practice, VPPR Architects. The practice shot to public attention for one of their first buildings, the multi-award-winning housing project Otts Yard in Tufnell Park in North London, a complex and overlooked infill site where the practice also acted as developer. Tatiana and her two co-directors have gone on to win numerous awards, including the RABA London Emerging Architect of the Year Award in 2015, and were shortlisted the same year for the RABA House of the Year Award. For this week's episode, I joined Tatiana in her practices studio in Bethnal Green. I first came across your work, I think, from Otts Yard. I came across with a, I think back in the day with a Reba jury. That was the first big project you did in the UK together as a practice. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Otts Yard, maybe?
So we set up in 2009, and we set up on the basis of the fact that we had one project for a Muse House gut refurbishment in Marble Arch, which is called Split House. Okay. And we moved back from America. It was in just after the crash.
Yeah.
And there was a kind of
difficult time for architecture.
Yeah. And it was a sort of exodus of expats, basically, from New York. We were all working in New York. Right. Pretty much everyone British that we knew left in that.
Was that because the market in the States was...
Yeah, there were sort of just mass layoffs everywhere.
Right.
And we weren't ourselves laid off, but we could feel it kind of crashing around us.
Right.
And this opportunity came up and we just thought it was a good time. And we felt that we had probably not quite enough experience, but maybe just enough to get away with it. None of us had any professional qualifications yet.
Right. Okay.
But we did have experience on doing gut refurbishment of a Muse House, and Catherine had very specific experience of doing one in the same street.
Yeah.
So we felt confident enough that we could use that as a template.
Okay.
And we did that and we came back.
So New York, it's kind of hard to remember now, that kind of 2008, 2009 period, that was when things were really tanking. Well,
it went from boom to bust. And I remember, you know, one year I was working at Field Operations, James Corner, which was amazing experience.
We'll come on to that. Yeah.
It went from like, you know, parties at Pastis and like really glam kind of Christmas do's and clubbing with an open bar and all this kind of stuff to like then just like laying off lots of people sort of, you know, within the space of a few months. And it was very dramatic. And Catherine was at SOM.
Yeah.
And I had lots of friends at SOM who I'd been to university with in the States. And there were these, they went from about 600 people, I think, to about 300 in the space of about 4 months. And everyone would, you know, at a certain time of the day, every once every 2 weeks or once a month or something, I would get all these little G-chat things popping out from all my friends there. And they'd be like, it's starting. And
people called into offices. And
they just announced a list of names on the Tannoy system. And you go down to HR and you came back and all your computer systems were switched off and inaccessible and all your stuff was already in a box on your desk and you just be straight out the door.
Like in the banks, like when you see them leaving.
Like in the banks. And anyone on a visa basically had to get out of the country within a week. So it was really intense and you know, sort of whole teams would be sacked around, you know, you'd be sitting there. So it was pretty
Then a kind of preemptive, you didn't want that happening. You thought you'd jump before...
Jump before the ship sank. So, yeah, we kind of came back. We had this project and Catherine and I both had inherited a bit of money from grandparents. We wanted to put into a development project because we had a theory, which I think is correct, that really the best business model for an architect would to be your own client and to develop your own buildings. And it gives you the creative freedom and it means that you make the money in the end that normally the client makes that you don't see. So I think it was the right move. Yeah. And we bought a plot of land in Tufnell Park. Yeah. Seemed really, really expensive at the time. Yeah. And now we realise we bought it for a song.
Yeah.
And it's...
Hindsight's a wonderful thing.
I know. 2 minutes from the tube station, really beautiful backland plot. Very private, very quiet. But with all the local amenities, since we bought it, like the whole high street got redeveloped with like cute butchers and fishmongers and whatnot. It's like a fantasy high street. And
did it have planning permission, the site? Was there?
Yeah, it had planning permission for a single story, four bedroom house.
Right.
That was kind of okay looking, was pretty not particularly exciting. And the planners said there's no way you'll get more than that on this site.
Right.
And then somehow we managed to argue that with two-bedroom houses, we were not increasing the number of bedrooms on the site in total.
Yeah.
And somehow we managed to get some more height to the buildings, which I'm not sure we would even get away with now. But it was not in a conservation area, you know, because it was off the street. So maybe that was part of it. But we managed to kind of make 1.5-story buildings with mezzanines. And we really, it was a crazy triangular shaped site and we just really went with the triangles obsessively down to all the kind of fine details.
The windows and that. Yeah. Okay.
And we put a lot of our ideas that come into the other projects were kind of crystallized in that project.
Right.
And we spent a very long time designing it. You know, like it was like, you know, a year of just...
Because you had the time, presumably, did you?
Well, I guess because other projects with kind of real clients seem to always take precedence and they always get kept getting put on the back burner.
Yeah.
And also because we just really wanted it to be really good.
Yeah.
And so you were
conscious that
many...
it would be then a kind of a showcase for the practice for you. You thought you would need a kind of halo project.
Yeah, a halo project and also just something... that would kind of prove that you could have really good contemporary architecture that would sell really well.
Yeah.
That like it's you know, that somehow we felt, particularly coming back from America, that London felt very conservative, like in terms of the kinds of projects that people would sort of deem acceptable or good projects or whatever. And so we wanted to do something that was a bit
out there,
more radical and out there and show that that could still be,
commercially viable.
Commercially viable.
Okay.
Which it really was beyond our wildest dreams. But I think very much helped by a rising tide, to be fair.
Kind of lucky. I mean, difficult timing, I suppose, setting up a practice even here in 2008, 2009, midst of a recession. Was the housing, I mean, obviously commercial is one thing, but many practices, you know, emerging practices start off with resi and...
The thing is that when you set up a practice, the very early days, unless you've gone from like a big practice and you've carried some clients with you or something, the very early days of setting up a practice are going to be doing some kind of house extensions and like refurbishment things. And all these small projects, they go on during a recession, and they probably, in fact, have more of them during a recession because people don't want to move.
Yeah.
So, in fact, we, you know, our instinct, which I think was right, was that we were going to have to do those projects anyway.
Yeah.
We might as well get them done now while there aren't any big projects around. And then when big projects are around, we'll be ready for those.
Yeah.
We'll have cut our teeth already. And I think that sort of proved to be the case.
Yeah.
Although we could do with some bigger projects.
We'll come on to those projects. So you moved to the States in straight after... You moved actually for university then to Columbia.
Yeah. Jessica and I both studied in the States. She was at Princeton and I was at Columbia.
Okay.
We were there about the same time.
Okay.
Catherine was at the AA.
Okay.
And...
I'm going to confuse people then. Maybe we're going to jump right back. Otherwise, we're going to jump around too much. Yes, the kind of, you know, what led you onto the path of becoming an architect? I've spoken to a lot of people and, parents are architects and they go on to become architects.
My mother's an architect.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's an architect.
And she, when I was growing up, all the things that we did together were all related. They were all kind of making things and design stuff. And she's very good with her hands. She's very good at making stuff.
Okay.
She has, you know, she's a really excellent designer, one of the best designers I know. And so all of my interests were kind of led to architecture, but she always said, don't be an architect.
Right.
They don't earn any money. And I think particularly when she was younger, she was like, there's no room for women in architecture. It's just rubbish. Just don't even go there. Don't bother. Don't put yourself through that. And she was like, be a research scientist. be a filmmaker. Just don't be an architect. But then, you know, as I said, all my interests pointed in that direction. So I'd actually applied to Cambridge to read history. My school also was very, very academic and very focused on kind of the big kind of academic subjects like, you know, physics and history.
Three and maths and those. Yeah,
those sorts of things. So that seemed like the obvious, the obvious thing. And then I kind of took a year out and spent it doing kind of photography.
So after A-levels, was that?
After A-levels, doing photography. I did a film course and I did some work experience at David Chipperfield Architects in Berlin.
Wow, okay.
And I just loved it.
Yeah.
And I was like, what am I doing? I don't like history that much. Like, I'm interested in it, but it's such a slog.
Yeah.
So much more fun to make, you know, pretty drawings.
Yeah.
So I managed to change subject by the skin of my teeth. And
so you'd applied to university, but with a year out, so you'd applied for the next year. Right.
Yeah, I was very lucky to be able to change subject.
Yeah.
And then I met Jess and Catherine on my first day
at Cambridge. Right.
And we were just really, really close friends all the way through.
Yeah.
I don't know that we necessarily specifically talked about setting up practice together, but we did do some kind of joint things. Jess and I made lots of films together, kind of like stop motion animations and like crazy, crazy films. It was a kind of fantasy. And then we all went off and did our postgraduate degrees at different places. And Jess and I went to America and Catherine was in London. And when Catherine graduated, she was sort of jealous that we were all having a really good time in New York.
So she liked the parties and the
So she came out and got herself a job at SOM.
Okay.
And we just had a really good time there.
And from studying architecture in Cambridge, what made you think I want to go to the States?
I wanted the opposite thing. I wanted to know, Cambridge has a very, and I think still does, maybe it was less so. It was very intense when I was there because Dalibor Vesely was still alive and Peter Carl was still there. And it had this really clear school of thought that was based on kind of phenomenology. And it was very conscientious and ethical and had a very strong opinion about what was right and what was wrong.
Okay.
And I remember Dalibor specifically criticizing Columbia for like Bernard Tschumi trying to introduce paper to studios and how rubbish it was. And it never didn't work. And the paper started coming back in. And, they were very critical of all the kind of Deleuze stuff and you know, all this kind of emergence theories and stuff that was quite big on the East Coast. And I was like, okay, like this provokes such a strong reaction in them. It must be something really interesting about it.
It's a revel coming through.
Yeah, exactly. So I went, and it was just the like opposite extreme.
Yeah.
And you could just have so much fun there. You could just make something and make it look really cool and really amazing. You didn't have to worry about the users of the building or whether it was appropriate to its context. It was just about form making and it was incredibly liberating.
Right.
So I loved that.
And that was straight away then after Cambridge, you both?
I worked for a year in London at Stanton Williams.
Before going off to the States?
Before going off to the States.
So I was an architectural assistant there.
Okay. I was an architectural assistant there. And that was really fun. So I loved that office.
Yeah.
It was only like 30 people at the time. And everyone was just young and really outgoing. And we just had a blast.
Yeah.
It was really it was a lovely place.
Yeah. I mean, you said the kind of... I was thinking, why Columbia, really? But you said it, yeah, there's a particular...
Yeah. I got into Yale as well, and maybe Yale in a way from British perspective seems somehow more prestigious in a way. I don't know. But I just like, if I'm going to spend 3 years in America, spend all that money on the fees, and I be in New York.
Yeah. Okay, it's a kind of world capital.
Yeah. And I'd never really been to America before, like I'd been once.
Right. So it was quite a big step. 3 years for not. And then to graduate. Where are we? Graduated 2007. I mean, how did you get to stay on in the States after?
I got a job at Field Operations.
Okay.
And I had a year on my student visa. I was allowed to work, and then they got me a proper work visa.
Okay.
And so I stayed there for about 3 years.
Okay.
And I worked on the High Line Park. Yeah, that was mainly my project there.
Wow. Okay.
That was amazing to work on. I mean, it was very fraught.
What stage did you come in? I mean, what were they kind of, that's big.
So phase one, which was up to, I think, around 20th Street, was on site.
Right. So they'd won the competition. Okay.
Phase one.
And was that part of your, I mean, when you're picking, looking at practices to work?
Not really,
what kind
no.
of drew you to...
I just loved the landscape stuff.
Right.
I went into the office and I just loved all of the work. It was so beautiful. All of the, you know, all the products of the work were beautiful. And it just, it also was a really beautiful office.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to be in here.
I want to work in this place. Yeah.
And it was a very woman heavy office. I think that's maybe just to do with landscape for some reason. It seems to attract women.
Right.
Maybe it was because James Corner likes working with women, I'm not sure.
Okay.
But there were, it was a kind of, I think, majority women in the office. And the other place I applied to was Dulles Gofidio Renfro, where there was one woman in the whole office other than Liz Diller.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not sure this is for me.
Right.
So, you know, they were working on the High Line as well.
Yeah.
But Field Operations were actually the lead team, although they rarely get credited with that. People rarely, they always think of it as a Dulles Gofidio project, and mainly because, you know, they lecture more in architecture schools and James Corner lectures in landscape school, so landscape people think it's
it's all them.
Architects
and,
think it's
never the two shall meet.
But it was really cool because, well, phase one was on site, phase two was in going to tender, and phase three was in schematic design. So it was like I had in one go all three phases of the project, but just along different parts of the of the building. And there was an amazing time before some vandals got up there and vandalized some of the new stuff. But before that, we had a key to the site. And I you know, I remember going, the office was quite near Hudson Yards. I could go to like one of the top end of the site, get onto the site completely on my own and go down to inspect various parts of the work. And I remember being up there and like the sun was setting and it was so beautiful, and taking pictures and doing measurements and things, and then kind of dressed up to go out in West Village, and like, but with my hard hat and then like walking down the High Line completely on my own, and then going down at Gansevoort Street and like going to a party. It's just really, really special, that.
And knowing something about knowing these things are special at the time as well. We can often look back at things and think that was a special time, but there's something I think amazing about knowing it's special at the time and you really appreciate it.
Then. Yeah, I always remember that that day.
So Catherine joined you then, you and Jessica in New York.
Yes. Yeah. Jessica was working at Front, which is a facade company that does lots of really amazing facades for big name practices, kind of star architects. Okay. And Catherine was at SOM. Mm. And so we were all in very different kinds of practices.
We'd all reach that same kind of decision at the same time then.
Yeah, too. Well, the News House project came through Catherine.
Yeah.
And I think she thought I had maybe more experience than I did. I think she wrote me in to help with the experience, and she'd always wanted to work with Jess, so she kind of wrote. We didn't waste too many of us to work on that small project, but we didn't really know anything about how to cost a project or fees or anything like that at the time. And so so we came back. We set up. We decided to invest money in a site, and Ott's Yard was one of the first sites that we visited.
Right.
We just saw it on an auction site and we went and we fell in love with it. And it was a beautiful sort of summer's day in August. Yeah. There's butterflies everywhere. The whole thing was overgrown. It was really romantic. And I think everyone was just on holiday or something.
Yeah. And quiet kind of.
Yeah. It kind of.
Oh, in the auction, do you mean?
Yeah. I think someone else would have taken it if it had been at a different time of year in a way. Right. But the woman who owned it, had just been widowed and she needed to sell it immediately because the planning permission for it was about to expire.
Right.
And Catherine actually wasn't in the country for the auction, so she gave me, and I didn't have the money for the deposit, so she gave me a blank check. She gave me two blank checks. She said, "You're going to mess one up." Yeah. I'm like, "No, I'm not." And then I was so surprised because we had agreed this upper limit that there was no way I would go over because I was too terrified.
Yeah.
And the bidding stopped one bid below that upper limit. So we exactly predicted the price, like precisely. Okay. And I was so shocked that I kind of, when the other guy stopped bidding, I kind of fell out of my chair, literally. It was like sprawling on the ground. And I went and wrote out the check and I wrote it out in dollars.
Right,
because I was in so much shock, so it was so.
So you did use the other second check. So, yeah, she knows you too well.
Yeah.
I guess. So it was the first project you started on, and then picked up other projects along the way. What else kind of came along then?
Yeah. So there was a cookie bar in New York, which was a kind of remnant of a project that we thought we would get when we were there, but the client actually never went ahead with making the cookie shop. But we did do an installation for this kind of pop-up, which was made out of cookie cutters that we riveted together by hand and installed in the window of a hairdresser's. Made it all ourselves. And it was really, really stressful. And we decided that we probably weren't going to make stuff ourselves anymore. Yeah. And then I guess when Ott's Yard got planning, we met a developer who had a really similar site and he was looking for architects for the site. And he really liked Ott's Yard. And I think he saw that we were young, probably inexpensive and eager and we got on well. So that was the key thing. And
so at that time, it was the three of you work. I mean, you weren't employing other people then. It was the three of you. Do you remember when there must be something about when you first take on a member of staff.
I think it was around 2010, 2011.
Right.
I think we were shortlisted for the Coca-Cola Olympic Pavilion.
Right.
Which would have been a huge break for us. And it was really devastating when I went to Asif.
Asif Khan, who won
won it. And we almost killed ourselves over that project. We worked so hard. We didn't sleep. It was like doing finals all over again. I mean, we just put everything in. And maybe we put too much in. I think we maybe it was somehow got overcomplicated or something. I don't know. It was, but it was a really cool design. It had these kind of moving platforms and the skin stretched over it. So the whole building would sort of pulsate and move, and you could have different configurations of stages by moving out these platforms. And it was, you know, we still want to build it for someone, but we haven't found the right person yet. And
and often, I mean, a lot of people I speak to, they say, it's always really interesting, the competition. Yeah, people focus, I suppose, so much in the history of a practice on the competition wins. But even as I say, I was talking to Patty Hopkins the other day, was talking about ideas she had come up with for fabric membranes and things, and she was determined to use them somewhere, and that kind of ideas come back again.
Yeah.
So when that was in the run-up to this, that was sort of similar sort of time, 2009?
Must have been, so 2010, 2011.
Okay, a bit later.
And we took someone on partly to help with that, because it was a kind of unmanageable amount of work.
Yeah.
And at the same time we had, it was maybe just after that, we got a project for a lingerie shop in New York for a fit out.
Yeah.
And so we were doing all the design. They had an executive architect there who was stamping the drawings.
Right.
And we did all of the fit out. And that was a really, really tight turnaround, because it was retail.
Yeah.
So we needed, you know, all hands on deck kind of thing. So that was when we started employing someone.
Were you conscious? Was that a big kind of...
Yeah, I mean, we held off doing it for so long because we were so scared about having to pay someone. And then we just realized how much more work you could get done with an extra pair of hands. Yeah. And it was like this miracle.
Right.
But it is scary employing people. It's still scary employing people, because you have to keep bringing in the work to keep them employed.
So how many, so it brings us on to today, I guess. Yeah, how many people do you employ now? What's the
at the moment, the size there's of the practice? There's us, there's 8 of us.
Right.
So including the 3 of us.
Yeah.
So we're quite small.
Yeah.
We were up to 12 in the summer, and then we lost a couple projects. I think because people are getting a little bit scared about the economy and Brexit, and they're getting nervous. People are finding it hard to make their figures stack up, I'm finding. I mean, the construction costs have really risen, I think partly because the pound is so weak, partly just because a lot of people are building, I think. I don't know. Yeah. It's like construction costs are really high right now.
Mm.
And
so people are, I mean, a lot of developers thinking if we hold off for a year, we'll get cheaper construction costs.
I also think that stamp duty's has really hit, you know, the market's really taken a knock.
Yeah.
Prices have all had to contract a bit. Yeah. And so they can't really get all their figures to stack up for the kinds of expensive infill developments that we were doing, because those kind of infill things, the finishes and stuff that we put in, not very expensive, they're very ordinary, but to dig deep and to do quite complicated things sometimes with the roof to get light in really adds up, and so you can't cost it in the way that you would just an ordinary house being new built on a flat piece of land. And I think that, so those sorts of things are harder to do.
A lot of people were talking about that kind of, people talk about building on brownfield land and with a kind of housing crisis, that is one way of solving those kind of complicated, using efficient use of land. Do you think that people are moving away from that more? Is that just harder now?
I think that's the only land left in London. So that's
there's still the opportunity there. Yeah.
I think there's sort of, there's lots of different things going on, but I mean, land itself, because there are so few sites, the price of just brownfield sites, I think, is a bit overinflated on the small sites.
Yeah.
So, and then the end product has to be really good to sell well. So it's a complicated equation, and it is always shifting, and it's not a straightforward thing like, you know, Brexit's happening, so that's caused a problem. Like, it's so many different factors all combined. That's part of it, but it's
not
one. But I mean, Croydon Council, we're doing 3 projects for them now on infill sites.
Right.
I mean, they're certainly taking the bull by the horns in that respect. And they're looking at all of their infill sites across the whole, all of their stock. Yeah. And they've got about 50 sites they've identified.
Right.
And about, I think about 8 architects, brick by brick, who are owned by Croydon Council.
And were they won by competition? How did you kind of pick up the project?
You just got the project.
Right. Okay.
We just got the project. And that was a real relief. I think the competition thing is highly problematic, to be honest.
Yeah.
And we've been really burnt by it. I mean, it's so expensive to do a competition. Yeah. And then you don't win it. You know, most of the time you don't win it.
Yeah.
And the amount of work that goes into that. And
effort and...
Yeah. And it's actually all of the values in that bit. Yeah. All the value you add is in that concept stage, because that's when you're doing the design that no one else could come up with.
All the thinking and all the rest.
Yeah. And you have to think through the detail of it. You have to think about certain rules to do with refuse collection or the fire truck access. You have to work through everything from the beginning, because otherwise you design something that's undeliverable. Mm. And so I think people don't really think you just do a sketch and send it in.
Here's
but it's like weeks and weeks of work, and then you never get remunerated for that.
No.
I think that's a cultural thing that really is
that
problematic.
The same in the States? I mean, I'm kind of interested in that difference. Competitions are a way of working there. Are they in the same way?
I think it's the same.
Right.
We haven't done any competitions there. Okay. What's different in the States, and architects do charge more in the States. I mean, they're still squeezed, but they seem to charge more for residential projects. What's different is that the title is not only protected, but the architect needs to stamp the drawings.
Right.
So not just anyone can submit a planning application or, you know, a building regs application or build the house.
It has to be stamped by, at the very least, by an executive
architect. And so... your job function is protected. You're a necessary part of the process.
Yeah.
And that immediately has to add more value.
Yeah.
That's a problem that I think, you know, we don't have that here.
No.
You could really not have any architects on a project, and project manager could do it and it would look really crummy. It would look terrible.
Yeah.
Wouldn't sell well at all.
No.
But I don't know. I mean, there are increasingly clients in Britain who do care about the quality of design, but it's also like the majority of building, majority of clients obviously don't, because you can see it all around. I mean, it's frightful what gets built.
Yeah. Okay. And then I suppose I'm interested in, you talked a bit about the conscious decisions in when you set up the practice and thinking about sensibly the finances and where the money was in the profession.
Mm.
I guess further along in the development of the practice, is there a vision for where you're going or for what the
I think we would still love to do our own developments, but now the market's kind of run away from us and we can't really afford to do it.
Okay.
So we're kind of thinking that through, and I suppose it, you know, a normal developer would just get investors and things.
Yeah.
But you kind of have to put a bit of money where your mouth
capital.
Is.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know. I also think it's a difficult climate to be developing in right now. And I think maybe in a couple of years, it'd be better to look at it when people know where they stand.
Yeah. But the housing then, the kind of infill housing has been a model. And, you know, as you do one successful project, it leads on to other clients coming.
You do one good infill housing project, and now that's all the projects that we have almost.
Right.
And we you know, at one point there were kind of like eight of them in the office or something. All at the same time. And they're really fun because often they're not on the street.
Yeah.
So, and because they're not like an existing typology, you kind of get to reinvent the wheel a little bit.
Mm.
And in a way, all of our infill projects have been like different experiments with different ways of approaching it. So they're not all the same thing. They're all radically different from each other.
Yeah.
And they definitely end up sharing some characteristics to do with really the section and putting the living space upstairs and the bedrooms downstairs.
That's, I mean, that must be really labor intensive though. I guess a lot of people, they find a concept and then you kind of churn out the concept a little bit. You're having to put love and attention into every project from scratch.
It's a lot of labor, but it's the bit that we enjoy the most. So it's the bit that we don't want to let go.
It's
that early kind of approach to the site and trying to find some kind of, trying to shoehorn some kind of really clear geometric idea into a kind of funny ad hoc bit of land is a challenge that we really enjoy.
Okay.
and that they have a kind of distinctive and kind of coherent language to them.
Yeah.
And I suppose a bit of it is a slight element of rebellion against the, the kind of idea of context that was so like drummed into us.
Yeah.
At Cambridge, how important that was. And that is, tends to be how people think about architecture in Britain, and that has some kind of, there's a sort of slight righteousness about it, which I find a bit irritating. So we kind of try to work with the, I mean, they are very contextual projects. Yeah. And they don't actually look out of place. It's just the plans look crazy. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of mad looking plans. And then, but then the building materials and stuff are all like nice stock bricks or whatever. Yeah. And it just looks like it was always there.
Right. And I mean, looking around, there's a lot of awards up on the, on the walls. That is that important? How kind of important is that to the practice? That either kind of, I guess a lot of people find the work, you have to put a lot of work, a lot of thought into award winning buildings, and it's hard to charge for that time and that, but that kind of recognition, big recognition.
I also think we've got certain processes and ways of working now that we've discovered from doing lots of these kinds of projects that mean that we can, although they end up looking very different, they do have a kind of similar process. That now we can do them more quickly. I mean, arguably, it would be nice to have the time to take stock and do a totally different approach again. Kind of, but yeah, you never really get that. The client doesn't, they just want to see the deliverables, so they don't really know about
quickly,
the process.
Presumably, yeah. And three, I mean, that's the other kind of question then, I guess, is three directors, are you... Is one of you designated a lead on an individual project? Are you all kind of working together? How do you...
It's like a tree system. So we each head up a number of different projects with different teams. We all feed into all the projects.
Yeah.
And often, particularly on larger projects, it might kind of be more like two of us that look at the project, or a kind of... There might be one person that's mainly in charge, but there'll be a second person who knows enough about the project that they can... bounce ideas back and like you can discuss the meeting you just had with the client or something like that. And we're really genuinely really collaborative.
Right.
And we're very lucky to have found a way of working where we're kind of very good at not taking criticism personally, I think.
Right.
And we're very good at sort of sitting back and saying, like at the beginning, when there were just three of us, we would basically, at the concept stage, we would like each do a design.
Yeah.
And then the client would pick one.
Right. Yeah. So it was, and then like, you would all tuck in behind.
And then we would all tuck in behind. Right. And often we would look at the three designs and be like, actually, this is the one we want to push for this site this time, even if it wasn't ours or, you know, because you get quite attached to what the one you've been working on. But actually, you were quite good at sort of choosing, and it's been very even whose design has been the one to kind of go ahead in a way.
And I guess as strong friends, you're able a little bit more to take criticism from friends rather than from others.
Well, I think so. I mean, the first year or 2 years, we fought a lot about, you know, what was the right way to go about something. Yeah. And then we somehow, through those arguments, we... kind of came to a working process that now we all, it'd be possibly difficult to tell whose was whose.
Right.
I think you would still tell. There are, you know, still differences that I, you know, we'd be able to see, but I'm not sure
externally
whether you'd be able to see. I mean, it's this sort of thing, you spend so much time with each other and you end up wearing the same clothes. And like,
is this mine? Is this someone else's?
The same voice. Yeah. And like,
And that, I mean, sort of, you know, other bigger practices where people with directors within the practice take on or discover different skills, you know, whether that's the kind of skill for the finances or skill for the costings or the development. Do you find, have you kind of settled
into... We've been told to do
kind of...
that. Again, that was sort of, you know, we did a business course and, you know, all the business books you read.
Right.
You know, like Skidmore, Owings and Merrill, there was a, you know, a kind of, I think an accountant, a designer and a marketing person or something.
Yeah.
Strategy person.
Yeah.
And we we don't have that. We tried to do it. We tried to divide up the roles.
Right.
And it just didn't work. And then like someone goes on maternity leave and we have to take over that job anyway. Yeah. So
you might as well keep the skills amongst you.
Yeah, and actually rotating the skills is quite useful because, for instance, like the most stressful job is obviously the finance job because you're trying to keep
practice afloat.
Yeah. And if you're not working on it, then it seems less important somehow. Yeah. Like it's just, you know, not the first thing you're thinking about. So rotating that thing is quite important because then everyone gets to appreciate the you know what it takes to make the practice. Yes. And similarly with PR or kind of operations, we've all kind of pitched in with that.
Right.
And it's really matured now, and I think we were really chaotic for a long time, which I guess most practices probably are. I mean, you're not taught any of that really properly. And
do you think that was a kind of failing in the architecture schooling system you went through then? I mean, do you wish that had been? It's interesting. I mean, you talked about going to a business course. That was
we felt ill-equipped.
Right.
We got to a point and we were like, why are we not making any money? Like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
Like, we're working so hard.
Yeah. And long hours. And right.
Yeah. Like, okay. This doesn't make sense. How does everyone else do it? And then you slowly realize that like a lot of people are not making it. and we put ourselves through a business course. And
where did you do that? Where was that?
It's called, oh God, I'm going to have to get you the name. No. Yeah. London Business Consulting. Parag Prasad.
Oh, yeah.
He's associated with Museum of Architecture.
Right. That was fairly recent though, was it? You did that one, didn't you?
It was 3 years ago, maybe.
Okay, right.
And he's done lots of architecture practices now. Yeah. And it was useful, not just for him, for his information, but just being in a class with other architects with different kinds of practices and hearing how they...
Similar problems.
Yeah, similar problems and how they deal with them.
Okay.
But we never really had an official mentor. It would have been good, I think. We've had people who've been really helpful, like Joe Van Hanegan, who used to rent desks at Van Hanegan Howard, and they kind of mentored us right at the beginning. And then there've been other people who've been very helpful.
It's a strangely collaborative industry or profession, actually. I mean, when you think about the idea of lawyers mentoring other lawyers in order to help them get their businesses going, I find that quite hard to imagine
they're
kind of competitive. Yeah, that
they probably have more official mentorship schemes.
Maybe that's what's lacking in the profession. And then
I think there could be something. Right. I think there really ought to be some kind of mentorship hierarchy that's more official, because I think we would really have benefited from having, well, we did have it to some extent, but maybe in a really official capacity where you actually meet someone, I don't know, once a month and look at everything with them, and they sort of tell you. We had a few meetings with people who kind of did that, told us about rules of thumb for calculating fees and what you needed to do each month and stuff. And they were really helpful things to do.
And you feel the practice is more kind of efficient in the way it costs jobs now and allocates time and allocates.
I think we're just more precise.
Right.
But we also now have the data to be precise with, so which we didn't really have. We didn't record any time for ages, for instance.
Okay. And you spent then, to jump back a little, am I right, you spent a bit of time teaching that part?
So I had taught, when I was in New York, I had taught at Columbia as a kind of assistant in the graduate school, and I'd also run a drawing class, like an advanced drawing class. And I came back here and applied to do a studio at the Architecture Association, and they didn't have space for us, but they did have a couple of teachers who needed a sort of someone else to teach with, like a pair. And so I taught with Maria Fedorchenko at the AA for 3 years, in her first 3 years. Right. And that was really amazing. And she's really incredible theorist, but she's like very feisty and kind of energetic, and it was, you know, it was quite kind of, everything was quite sort of I don't know how to describe it. Intense. It was very intense. Okay. But really interesting. And we had some really amazing students, and one of them got a Reba bronze medal 1 year. Wow. And they did some really beautiful work, really beautiful drawings. And then Jessica and Catherine were teaching at Cardiff. Jessica was teaching at Cardiff for a good few years. Yeah. And then she got a studio at the AA with a friend of ours, Lily Jenks. So she's teaching there. Right. She's still teaching that. And I left the AA then.
Okay.
And then we just got a studio at Columbia this semester, which has been amazing. So we're all kind of flying out.
Wow.
Every few weeks. Yeah. And the next person comes back and we're in this kind of rotation.
One at a time to US.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. And it's an amazing school. It's really amazing to be there with all the other tutors who are doing really interesting things.
I suppose, I mean, we kind of, earlier on you alluded to it, your mother saying about women in architecture, and I'm always a little bit, I suppose until relatively recently, it would have been fairly unremarkable to talk about a practice. I suppose no one would comment really about a practice being run by three men. Yeah, it would just be seen as kind of unremarkable. And actually until pretty recently, you know, you talk about panels in architecture at various awards or talks and things that would be fairly common. You'd see 4-5 men up on the panel and no one would really kind of comment. So I suppose the time you were setting up as a practice, it was one of the things that was noted was three women.
I think it's obviously for us, it's been hugely beneficial because we stood out at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we kind of seems obvious really, but, you know, it is a benefit to be in the minority like that.
Yeah.
If you have everything else go, if you've got good design and you, you know, we've been very lucky with, you know, being able to do our own developments and that kind of thing. Yeah. So financially, we're very lucky and in that respect. And so that's been very good for us. I think it's, we're definitely finding that that works really well on the smaller projects, but they're getting the step up to the bigger projects is quite a big effort for us. And I don't know if that's to do with being women or not.
Right.
I think there's certainly something about networking, which is different.
Yeah.
Like if you're a bunch of blokes, you can go down to the pub or go to the football or whatever. And it feels very sort of straightforward.
Yeah.
Whereas I think it is slightly different if you're a woman and you know, the developers are particularly in that, you know, for those big projects.
The developers are men.
Are all men.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly.
Yeah.
You go to MIPIM and it's like, you know, and I was told this was a good year for women. And I was like, everyone. Yeah. It's like, really?
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's all the finance people and all the real estate people and all the developers are all men. So I think there's something, to be fair, quite human about wanting to work with people like you. And it's something people should try to avoid, but it is kind of a natural trait. Like, I think that's sort of, you know, you have to actively work against that instinct. I mean, you know, we employ all women at the moment. I mean, we employ people like us.
Yeah. Everyone does it. Yeah.
Everyone does it a bit. Yeah. And, you know, we have employed men, we do employ men, but I can see how it happens on that level. And then I think the other thing is just the old obvious thing that, you know, architects just are not in a position to command high enough fees to deal with. This kind of has two aspects to it. One means that there's just nothing to put in a pot for someone's maternity leave or to put on top of the statutory stuff.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that when salaries go up, fees don't go up. You've got the same number of people working, it's costing you more. You can't hire someone else to come in and do that job. People end up doing really long hours.
Mm.
And
if you have to leave at 5 to go and pick your child up from nursery, you can't do those hours. And you can't, like, it's so exhausting. You go and, you know, looking after a child in the evening, like, I don't know how people go back to work after they put the child to bed. I mean, I definitely can't, unless it's really urgent.
Yeah.
And on the weekends, you're looking after your child, so... And, you know, and men could be doing that too.
Yeah.
And sometimes they are. And I've got an amazing husband who shares all of that. And Jess has an amazing husband who shares all of that with her. Mm. And that definitely really helps.
They're not architects.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, and you're not paid enough. You can't pay your nanny enough. I mean, nannies, you know, have a full-time nanny in London. And it's like, you know, looking at £40,000. They're on PAYE. They're a whole thing. It's like, how do you pay that after tax? I think I know lots of, you know, people have had people having babies around me at the moment, and there's always this question about shared maternity and paternity leave, and men feel somehow, often feel somehow shy to ask for it, like it wouldn't be kind of acceptable, it'd be sort of looked down on. But I think that's changing, and I think that will make a big impact on equality. In some ways, but nothing will deal with the fact that if the fees aren't high enough, then
affording
you can't afford
staff to.
The hours thing is difficult. I mean, we've actually found that. So when Jessica and I took maternity leave at exactly the same time, poor Catherine was left holding the fort, and we just got this huge, you know, 3 projects in from Croydon. It's a huge amount of work that had to be done. And so, in fact, it was really good for the practice because we knew we had to hire someone experienced and we'd been really scared to do that for a long time. We had, for a long time, the first people we had in the office were just part ones. We had tons of part ones, really high turnover. Yeah. They were really good, but they'd, you know, stay a year or two at most. Yeah. And so we got an experienced employee, and she came in, she was amazing, and she just wanted to do 4 days a week because she was coming back from maternity leave. And for us that was brilliant, actually, because we were quite nervous about risking, you know, there's a big difference between paying someone 4 days a week and 5 days a week, but you still get the experience, and actually, as long as you're efficient, 4 days a week is plenty.
You can get a lot done in
4 days. You can get everything done in 4 days. So actually we've sort of felt that sort of women on part-time, not like 2 days a week's hard, 3 days is probably hard, 4 days a week, it's great. It's very good value for money.
What, 25% less, 30%
less? Yeah, and it's good that, and they know that we'll be sympathetic.
Yeah.
They, child is sick or something, or they need to leave early, or it's not going to be a problem.
Or do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And the only thing we just ask is that, if there is an emergency call that can, you know, needs to be made on Friday, that they can do that from home or whatever.
Yeah. As other people would at weekends or...
Exactly, as anyone would.
Yeah, okay.
So, I don't know, I think the only thing we can really offer people is that kind of flexibility.
Yeah, and
But, I mean, I think that the long hours thing, you know, there are practices, there are very successful architect practices that are built on a model which is based on university, where everyone works till 2 in the morning every night. And if you're paying someone to work 8 hours a day and they're working 16 hours a day, well, you're actually only paying them half what you should be. So how do you compete against that if you're paying someone properly full salary and they're only working 8 hours a day, although they're working what they're employed to work? It's really hard to compete with that.
I'm interested then, you know, it's sort of slightly more profession-wide thing, but when thinking about other professions, you talk about the competition, the kind of Coca-Cola competition and the hours put in there, because presumably because you wanted to win, but also because you were...
We loved it.
Loved what you were doing.
Yeah.
And I suppose when you have a profession that you love quite so much, being ruthless enough to...
Yeah.
Say, look, we love this project. We want this to win an award. Maybe a couple of extra days' work is going to...
I know. And that's absolutely the case.
Yeah.
You're doing it partly for the love of it. And that's how the market prices you.
Yeah.
It's not like someone's going out to take advantage of you.
No.
It's just that's what we're doing to ourselves.
Yeah, we're not going to solve that problem here and now.
No.
So I guess then kind of just coming back to London, I was kind of keen to think about kind of, you talked a little bit about some early influences and things you find influential. We've asked most of the people we've spoken to about things maybe in London, maybe elsewhere that they find kind of inspiring. Are there any kind of, so, I mean, I say it's interesting that New York, do you find the kind of New York influence, the American influence coming into your work here?
I think there's something about, something very liberating about sort of feeling like you can be slightly irresponsible for a second, even if you then bring it back to being like really responsible and really contextual and doing all the things you're meant to do and that everyone appreciates and everyone talks about in architectural criticism and and all of that, and not being too flamboyant because it's sort of bad taste. That's very British, isn't it? To be too flamboyant because it's bad taste, or if you are, then in this very specific way that, you know, should be slightly postmodern or something. And I think like the joy of just kind of creating something for its own sake for a second is just, is one of the great, great pleasures of designing. And acknowledging that ultimately you're trying to make beautiful buildings, that beauty is an essential part of what you're doing. It isn't all just about it being practical or, and also that kind of surprising spaces have a kind of beauty to them as well. That the things that, you know, I mean, they're kind of obvious examples, but like the Villa Savoye, like going to see that when I was about 18 and just sort of realizing that the part of the joy is that it's not, it's just sort of not quite knowing what's coming next as you're walking through it. And these kind of little moments that don't need to be there, they don't actually serve a particularly practical purpose. It's all couched in these very practical terms, but it's just very, very playful. And you can imagine being a child and running around that, and it'd be so fun. And that's important, really. And it's okay. And it's okay for it to be fun.
I think that kind of playful stuff, do you think that's come into some of the infill projects you've worked on?
I hope so.
Do you think they're kind of fun? I mean,
I hope so. Yeah. It's what we've tried to achieve. And yeah, I think, you know, without being glib as well, I think that's, I think what we try to do. And we care very honestly also about kind of creating communal spaces and kind of a sort of neighborliness, which people are very skeptical of. But you know, I know it works because I live in one of the projects. Okay, I'm living next to my business partner and great friend. But also in some of our other projects in Red Church Street, we've done a similar kind of thing where we have kind of communal gardens and flats onto them. And it works really, really well there. And it really is a community just because of the spatial arrangement. Of course, you might always get like a weirdo or difficult person and a neighbor you don't like. But actually, you're sort of forced to be civil to them if you have to share a space with them and you have to negotiate with them. And most people are kind of fine if you talk to them. And like,
it's probably quite a good lesson for life, that.
I think living in all kinds of different types of spaces, you sort of realize that you can adapt to different things as well. At university, you know, there were college buildings where you had to cross a court to go to the loo in the middle of the night in the rain. But they were the most beautiful rooms in the university. So beauty was more important. I don't know. So I think that's, I don't know what that means, but
interesting. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for all your time. I'm really appreciative.
Thanks for coming.
Real run through of everything. That's amazing. From back in this, it must seem a long time ago, that 2008, 2009 period.
It feels like really recently. Yeah.
I'm sure that's a good sign. I'm sure that.
Yeah.
On the programme this week was the architect Tatiana von Prusen. You can find out more about Tatiana and her work at architecturemasters.org, where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter.
If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, as this helps others to discover the programme. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.